I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about a future for Indianapolis that is electric with possibilities. The city's plans to rely more heavily on electric and hybrid vehicles. We'll talk about what the city's doing, why it's doing it, and how it will work. We've got a high-voltage group of guests to discuss the subject. Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard, Paul Mitchell, President and CEO of Energy Systems Network, and Cole Willis of IPL. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today on No Limits about Indy's plug-in vehicle future, really about electric and hybrid cars and the use of vehicles that are not exclusively dependent on oil. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got a great group of guests today, starting with Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. Mayor Ballard, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here once again.
It's good to have you here. Paul Mitchell, who is the president and CEO of Energy Systems Network. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you here as well. And Cole Willis, who is with IPL. Cole, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Well, Mayor Ballard, I'm going to start with you on this. Why don't we talk a little bit about what the city is doing? There are a couple of initiatives, really, that are encompassing. One, the idea of the sort of being able to rent an electric vehicle or a hybrid one, and then also this plan to convert to the city's vehicle, whatever you would call it, to electric or hybrid options.
Well, we have to start a little bit with why we're doing this. This is I'm pretty passionate about this. I think as people may know that when you study what has been going on with the energy around the world in the last 40 years, the technology now allows us to change that dynamic, and particularly when it comes to oil and the money that we spend protecting the oil infrastructure around the world, that essentially allows us to send people who want to do us harm. That has got to change. I mean, I understand back when I was in the Gulf War back in 1991, we had to do that sort of thing. I get that to maintain the world economy, but most people don't know that we can move off of that dynamic right now, and that's what we're doing. So we committed last December to buy only plug-in hybrids, and I'm not sure your audience really all knows what plug-in is. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. But plug-in hybrids or pure electric vehicles, we will convert our truck fleet, including fire trucks, eventually to natural gas or some
other alternative. Fleet was the word I was looking for earlier. It's a tough one to remember.
And then we're going to help with the police cars and hopefully get 40 to 50 miles a gallon per police car, if not using a plug-in hybrid. That last move alone will probably save the city $6 million. I mean, that's the range, $5 to $6 million. So that's why we're doing this. I wanted to do this. I've been studying this for years, but as the mayor, unless you're saving a dollar, you really can't move on it, right? But the technology all changed, and it's moving pretty rapidly right now. And now the cities can save a dollar doing this. We're ahead of the other cities in the nation right now, and people are watching what we're doing, and they want to join us. And through the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and we can talk about that if you want to. But so we're moving in this direction because we think not only will the city save money, but also it will change the security dynamic around the world. It'll change essentially the balance of power. We will not be leveraged because of our dependence on oil anymore. We can go to the bargaining table from a position of strength at a certain point in time instead of having to negotiate knowing that eventually we're going to need oil from some of these countries that we don't necessarily want to deal with.
So let's talk about, you. As you say, you made the commitment in December to do this. What specifically are we doing as a city?
Well,
the steps. There are several steps.
Well, the three ones I mentioned, which is we're only for regular sedans, plug-in and hybrids. Trucks can be converted to gas, to natural gas, and we're working on police cars to make sure. Those are the three implementation steps that we're taking to move toward this. And there are things that are happening right now that we may be able to buy some vehicles or have some sort of leasing arrangement, something, whatever it might be, to move toward this in a quick manner. Troy Riggs, the public safety director, has already identified up to 1,000 cars in the public safety arena, not the responding police cars, but another 1,000 cars that probably can be converted as we do move forward in this. There's just so many things that we're doing, and we meet pretty much on a biweekly basis. The implementation meets on a biweekly basis to discuss the progress and how we're doing this. And there's lots of little pieces to it, obviously, but those are the big muscle movements on this.
Okay. Paul Mitchell, the mayor said that the technology has changed and evolved in a way that's made something like this feasible, whereas it wouldn't have been 20 years ago or
just 5 years ago.
Yeah, when you were first running for mayor, it wasn't necessarily. What are those changes that make this feasible now?
Sure. I think one thing that's important is to understand the legacy of Indiana and central Indiana, Indianapolis, really, in the development of electric vehicle technology. In the late 90s, early 2000s, General Motors developed the first electric car. It was called the EV1. And eventually, that's what made the Volt and all these newer vehicles possible. That work was done here in Indianapolis. So the people who designed the battery technology and the power electronics had worked at companies like Delphi, formerly Delco Remy. So we've had this long legacy in central Indiana around electric vehicle technology, and people have been working on this for decades. You're right that in the last 4 or 5 years, we've gotten to high volume production of these cars. And that really is two vehicles that were trailblazers in that regard. One was the Chevy Volt, and the other was the Nissan Leaf. So once Nissan and GM really committed to high volume production, where you could buy these cars at virtually any dealership in America, and were selling them at competitive prices, it changed the equation. Previous to that, you could get electric vehicles, you could get plug-in vehicles, but they were expensive.
What, in terms of, obviously there are more of them now. Originally, some of the concerns about electric vehicles were that they might be a little bit underpowered, that you could not travel in them for great distances. Have those concerns been addressed now and resolved?
Absolutely. One of the best people to articulate that is the mayor. He's been driving one of these cars now for the last several weeks, and power is no longer an issue. Range is no longer an issue. I'd let the mayor talk about his experience.
Well, that's okay. I'm sure the mayor's not going to tell us he's been hot rodding through the streets.
No, but I had the only plug-in hybrid pace car in the world in May, right? I get a pace car, and Chevy called up and says, they know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Does the mayor want a traditional pace car? Does he want a Volt? I said, I took the Volt.
Yeah.
And I drove the Volt to Atlanta for the Final Four to kind of prove a point that, these are normal cars. And the Volt has been, the last 2 years, has been the highest customer satisfaction rating of any car in America. That should tell you something. They're certainly not underpowered. Mm-hmm. They're not little toy boxes like people. These are normal cars. Mm-hmm. They're very speedy, especially from zero. I mean, they accelerate really rapidly, and they're very powerful cars. So that people just don't understand that. And on the plug-ins, once the electricity is out, for instance, on the Volt, but it's usually about 38 miles. Most people drive less than 30 miles a day. So think about that. You may never use gas, right? Mm-hmm. But once that's done, it just converts to gas. And on the Volt, the range was about 300 miles, so you just stop at a gas station and fill up and keep going. That's all you do. On the Ford Fusion, the new Ford Fusion, which is beautiful, looks like a Lexus. It's just a beautiful car, big, luxurious car. You get 20 miles on the plug-in piece, on the electric piece, and then it converts. And I think the range is 500 to 600 miles on that. You'd never know. And there's no, people do not understand where the technology is right now. And you just plug these cars into the wall. And I tell that to people. They think, is it an adapter? You got to buy this. No, you just plug it into the wall. That's all you do. And if you do it at night, you can, at the cheaper rates, 100 miles is probably a buck or two. Mm-hmm. On a traditional car, coal can verify this, I hope. I'll, but it'll be a buck or two. But, I mean, 100 miles in your car is probably 20 bucks. 100 miles on electricity is probably a buck or two. Now, think about that.
Well, this sounds like you've been giving your cue here, Cole.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of our things is IPL, about 2 years ago, implemented what we call our EVX rate. And what that is it's a rate that incentivizes electric vehicle owners to charge overnight. And if they are to charge overnight, it's about 40% of what their regular electricity is. And as the mayor said, you're looking at about $1 per 100 miles. If you convert that to a similar SUV, that's about $17, $18. So, I mean, there's significant savings that are available for customers that get into this technology and use it appropriately and are mindful. And when we found most of the EV drivers are very mindful of how they drive, their driving habits, and when they want to charge.
You just have to make sure you've got an outlet in your garage or whatever to plug into, or is that, and that's pretty, that, that's or a very long extension
yeah,
cord.
And it's just one tip, it's like plugging anything else in.
You can join the conversation if you want to. We're talking about electric hybrid vehicles by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We're getting an email question from a listener named Eric who says, why did we not capitalize on our abundant and cheap natural gas resources in concert with a Honda plant here in Indiana that produces the natural gas-powered Civic? It would have seemed to have been a perfect match. Mayor Ballard?
Well, Paul may be Paul, closer to that, but I would tell you, I've been down to that plant. I've seen the Civics made. It is good. And natural gas has its own dynamic to it. And we are converting our trucks to natural gas. It makes a lot of sense to convert trucks to natural gas. But, Paul?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges that natural gas faces is the fueling infrastructure and the availability of natural gas fueling. So for work trucks, it's not quite as much of a challenge because those trucks come back to the same place all the time. They tend to refuel the whole fleet. Passenger cars, we don't have as much natural gas fueling infrastructure available for passenger cars yet. Cars that run on electricity, we basically have outlets everywhere. So one of the nice things about electric drive, electric vehicle technology, especially for sedans, is that you can charge it at home overnight and you can take advantage of these lower rates. So the availability of the charging infrastructure, I think, is one of the limiting factors for natural gas sedans. But it's definitely a better alternative than internal combustion engine vehicles, so it's certainly something we should be looking at.
Well, and Cole Willis, I'll ask, how long does it take, say, with a standard electric vehicle, how long do you have to plug it in for it to be charged?
Is it
a process of an hour, or is it 8 hours?
A little bit lengthier than that, and there's actually different levels of charging stations.
Mm-hmm.
So the standard wall outlet that everyone has, if you have a 100% electric vehicle, that can be, 16 hours. That can be a little bit lengthy. But a lot of the EV customers have a level 2 charger, which is 240, very similar to an electric dryer plug. And with that, it takes 6 hours, 6 to 8 hours, and those numbers are slowly coming down. Mm-hmm. With the new models of Nissan Leafs, those have been cut down to under 6 hours, closer to 4 hours. And so it really allows customers and owners to charge overnight, to stay within, off-peak rates, and to be able to go out and, as the mayor said, most people don't drive the full 30 miles a day. Mm-hmm. So maybe they drive 15 miles and their car's only 50%. Well, now we can get that recharged in 2 hours. You can go to the mall, and we have locations throughout the city, and we have more charging stations coming. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit. But we're really working hard to make charging stations available so that if someone wants to charge at a movie or at a theater or at a at a mall, those are going to be available, and you can charge in the time frame.
Will that work? I mean, ultimately, if you're doing that, because while we're talking about the concept here, is it just you go to the movie, for example, to use your example, and you decide you want to charge, plug in, you're going to be sitting in the theater for 2.5 hours, probably closer to 3 with previews and all of that sort of stuff. Is it just you swipe a credit card and you're ready to go at that point, or
yeah.
How?
Yeah, there's a couple different options. We actually have stations. IPL has stations throughout the city. We already have 22 stations in place. Various property owners have put other stations in, and that's the typical method. Many of them have pay at point options where you can go in, you can swipe a card. Some have a subscription fee where you can just have kind of a key fob or an RFID mm-hmm. where You're enrolled into a subscription program. That's what IPL has. And you go in, you plug your car in, and you make the payment right there at the point of purchase. Leave your car plugged in, and most of the cars today have, they're very technologically savvy. So on your smartphone, you can pull it up, and it'll tell you where you're charged, what percentage, when you can go back and unplug and be ready to go. So these cars, not only are they a great alternative, but they also have great technology coupled with them.
You say there are already 22 charging stations. How many are we looking at ultimately to make this?
Well, we need to talk about Bolloré coming into town. I need to say one thing first. You know, on a pure Leaf, it may take 15, 16 hours, but if you get the plug-in, like the Bolt, it only takes 6 to 8 hours on a 110. I charged it overnight. It was always full every morning.
We are talking about Indianapolis's electric car future with Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard, Paul Mitchell, and Cole Willis. I'm John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indy's plug-in vehicle future. My guests are Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard, Paul Mitchell of Energy Systems Network, and Cole Willis with IPL. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi, John. Hello to the mayor.
Hello.
Just like to say, as a citizen, I'm really excited about what you guys are doing with the electric vehicles. And someone who's somewhat of a layman, I'm just kind of curious as to what the long-term plan is for the battery recycling. If you guys have my understanding is that after 10 or 15 years, the batteries actually have to be replaced, and what the plan is for that with the big fleet that we have coming up.
Were you on Twitter this morning? Were you on Twitter this morning?
Oh, no, I wasn't.
Okay, there was somebody who tweeted that, actually. What was the
plan? Okay.
And you referenced an article, Paul.
Okay, Paul Mitchell.
Yeah, let me take a crack at that. So there's a couple of different approaches. One is that with lithium-ion batteries, you're actually able to recycle them, mm-hmm. And you can reclaim about 90% of the material that's in that battery and put it into a future battery. Another option is what they call secondary life of electric vehicle batteries. So the battery may not be useful any longer on your car because your range has been reduced and you want that longer range, but it may be perfectly useful doing another function, providing backup power for a cell phone tower or being used on the grid to store electricity. So they're also talking about possibly having an end-of-life value for those batteries when they come off of the vehicles, and they may be used for a secondary function for another 15, 20 years before they're recycled.
So how long, I mean, before the thing is completely used up? I mean, are we talking
30 or 40 years?
The
shelf life of advanced lithium battery technology can be 30, 40 years.
That is remarkable. I mean, it does show how the technology has evolved. And I guess, Patrick, and thank you very much for your call and your question. I'd like to talk a little bit. I mean, we're now poised, obviously, to become certainly the nation's leader and maybe one of the world's leaders in embracing this kind of technology. Mayor, you'd mentioned right before we went to the break, a new initiative to the Bolloré and all of that. Could you talk a little bit about that? And then I'd like for us to talk about the ways this is going to change the city.
Sure. When I made that announcement last December, it did go across the nation pretty quickly, and other people were paying around the world. And I guess Bolloré is one of those groups that were paying attention out of Paris. And just a couple of years before, they had initiated a program called Autolib in Paris. Now, Vince Bolloré is a pretty wealthy guy, and he thought technology was changing. Also, you could do something different. And he, pretty much on his own dime, started this kind of service in Paris. And so Paris was the only place where this is occurring. And it made a lot of sense. It's essentially point-to-point. It's like a bike share program. You don't rent the car for the day. What you do is it's a subscription service. And if you're at a mall here and you want to go to the art museum, then you just drive the car to the art museum and go in the art museum and you give up the car. Mm-hmm. And then when you're getting ready to go, you go pick up another car and go someplace else, right? And that's what you do. And it was very successful. It was much more profitable sooner than they were expecting. And they were looking for a North American entry point. They talked to a lot of different cities, but I think they always had a little bit of an eye toward us because of what we announced last December. And sure enough, we were able to make it work. And we haven't signed the final contract yet, but we're very close. And so now he'll put in tremendous number of charging station cars and such.
Are there other than the fact that we've made this early commitment to doing it, were there other factors about Indianapolis that made the city attractive to them?
I think the fact that we had announced the post-oil technology move in December was attractive to them. I think, frankly, we had a lot of destination points that made a lot of sense that were not necessarily connected by mass transit. That was probably something that was attractive to them. I think they found willing people here also.
And how does that? How would this work with the push for a mass transit system here in the city?
But, as I found out when I lived in Europe, transit systems are complementary. I think this is a complementary move. Even if we were able to move a little bit more robustly on mass transit, as I and so many others want to, I think it would be a compliment to it.
And then I wanted to pick up the second part of my question that I piggybacked off of Patrick's, which is, how is all of this going to change the city? I mean, we're looking at changing the fleet completely by 2025, having this major new initiative that's going to create a different way for people to get around a city that, frankly, always has been very car dependent. I mean, there's a reason we have to have so many roads and so many lanes and all that.
Yeah, there is. But as I found out during the mass transit initiative in the last few years, visiting different cities, every city kind of says they're car centric, and we may be a little bit more than most, but I'm not so sure much more. I mean, even Denver said they were car centric initially when they went to a more robust mass transit. So I think what we're really trying to do is get to a certain point where people understand that this is viable, good technology that allows us to bring the troops home, allows us to stop spending $85 billion a year outside of the wars, $85 billion a year protecting this oil infrastructure. That's when we could get to the point where the consumer understands that it has a dramatic impact on our nation's health and, frankly, the world health, which is where I'm trying to go with all this. When I say health, I mean the balance of power, essentially strategic power, and it brings the troops home. It keeps the troops home because you're not going to tell me that we don't send troops out there in defense of defensive energy.
Let me take another perspective on this. I agree with everything the mayor said. I think what this also does with Bellori coming to town and with the city's commitment on fleets, just to put the perspective into some numbers, you're talking about potentially 500 electric car share vehicles, 1,000 charging stations, another several hundred, could be eventually 1,000 city vehicles that would be converted to plug-ins. And what that does is it eliminates the barriers of entry for this market. It makes it almost a no-brainer for consumers to make this choice to go electric as well, because the infrastructure's there. They can see the benefit that it's having in their community. And I think there's also a big push for younger people who are looking to live downtown, might not want to own a car, might not be cost effective for them to own a car. They now have this other option with the electric car share service.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that, but in some ways it's sort of an answer to the partial answer, at least, to the brain drain problem that Indiana's faced, where you're giving young people who are environmentally conscious a reason to come here and to build their lives here.
Absolutely, because we hear all the time that the younger professionals and sometimes even younger families want only one car, not two, and the younger professionals, so many of them do not want any car. So the subscription service with Bellori, it makes a lot of sense in combination with the bike sharing program. They can pretty much get around any way they want.
We are talking about Indianapolis's electric future here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Or you can connect with us, as Emmanuel did, via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Emmanuel sent us a tweet saying, "What are IPL and the mayor doing to ensure the electric grid is able to handle increased capacity of an EV fleet?"
Yeah, absolutely.
Cole, that would be you.
Yeah, that's a great question. Part of the reason IPL is in this is, one, because it's a great initiative, and Mayor talked about some of the reasons and some of the sustainability reasons. But one reason it's very important for us to be in this is because this is, and we talk about electric vehicles, and it's a major upgrade and a major impact on our system. And 2 years ago, we applied for a smart grid grant from the Department of Energy. And we were fortunate enough to receive that grant, and that's where our rates have come from. And that's where a lot of kind of this and working with Paul was really kind of the inception of a lot of this. Not necessarily the thought of it, but being able to move forward with a lot of these. And what that did was is it gives us an opportunity to study charging habits, to study grid impacts. And we've been doing that over the last 2 years, really taking a look at how people charge, how their loads affect our grid, and looking at that. And so far we've seen that with the shaping of our loads that peak and off-peak prices have produced, it's really not going to take a huge toll on our grid, and that our grid in place is we have a great grid, and we couldn't fully expect to be able to supply this without any negative feedback.
We are talking about Indianapolis and electric cars here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm thinking about level 3 charging stations. I have a Leaf, and one of the limitations of the Leaf is that it's purely electric, and that effectively limits the range to 70 miles. And I've been very happy with it, but one of the problems with the plants currently in Indianapolis is that it focuses only on level 2 charging stations, and I pretty much exclusively change on level 2 at home because it's much cheaper, and the level 2 chargers that are available, a lot of them cost too much money for what the electricity is delivered. So my question is, are there any plans for there to be level 3 chargers across the state? So with an electric car, we could go to Chicago, we could go to Louisville, we could go to Fort Wayne, we could go to the dunes, the wonderful, beautiful Indiana dunes, and able to charge on a level 3 charger, which would take only about a half hour. I've used all the level 3 chargers in Indianapolis already, but I feel confined to the city when I have an electric car. So,
Thank you very much for the question, Patrick. I'm going to try to get you an answer. I'd start first, Paul Mitchell, I'm going to throw that to you, but we probably ought to walk people through who do not have electric cars, the difference
what
between level one, level
yeah.
two, level what, yeah. we're, what we're talking about here.
Sure. I can try to do that really
okay.
quickly. And Cole mentioned it a little bit earlier, but there is this question about quick charging. So the first is level one. Level one is a 110 outlet like you have in your garage or on the wall across the room. The second is what Cole mentioned, which is level two, and that's 220 or 240, and that's about the same as a washer-dryer type of hookup. Then there's a third category of charging. It's called quick charging. Often it's referred to as DC charging because it's a direct current versus an AC charging. And those can charge cars very rapidly, sometimes between 15 and 30 minutes for a charge, and that's what this gentleman's referring to. So our organization, Energy Systems Network, through our Project Plug-In initiative, we did fund the installation of 3 quick chargers in the Indianapolis area. There's one at the Clay Terrace Mall, and there's one at a Walmart in Greenwood and one at a Walmart in Plainfield. So there is infrastructure, and we intentionally put it around the 465 loop because mm-hmm. we thought it's really more of a technology for people who are wanting to travel further distances with their electric vehicles. I don't think that we need a lot of quick charging in the city because as Bolloré comes to town and you've got virtually charging infrastructure almost wherever you go, the idea is you're able to plug your car in at home and pretty much anywhere in the city as you're driving around. I do think the gentleman's question about longer distance trips, if you're talking about wanting to take a Nissan Leaf to Chicago or so on and so forth.
Well, or if you wanted to drive to one of the coasts.
Yeah, then I think quick charging networks are important. Nissan has been making some investments recently in supporting quick charge infrastructure. They've brought out a quick charge station where the cost has been lowered dramatically. These used to be about $75,000 to $100,000. For a quick charging station. They're now getting lower, more like $15,000, $20,000. But it's still well outside of what an individual consumer would ever pay for to install in their own house. And I think as we see the market grow, you'll begin to see more quick charge infrastructure along highway corridors, at gas stations, at truck stops, et cetera.
Well, we see things. I mean, as Patrick was talking, I couldn't help but think, okay, even if a quick charge, if it's a 15 to 30 minute process, you know, it would be rather tedious just to sit in your car while that's going on. Does it make sense that, you know, to do things like, you know, combine them with coffee shops?
So, yeah, exactly. And I would point to the Clay Terrace Mall, where there's a quick charging station that also has a solar array and an energy storage system that we worked on with Duke Energy. And that was located close to a Starbucks intentionally because we thought it's a good type of time frame, that 15, 20 minutes to go get a cup of coffee or walk around the mall. So you may end up seeing quick chargers more at places like Walmarts and coffee shops than you would your traditional gas station.
We are talking about electric vehicles here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. There's a couple of listeners, one of whom is named Rick, has done. He says, I work with an Indianapolis-based manufacturer of electrical components for charging stations and inverters found in electric hybrid buses. I'd like to ask your guests for the best way to enter the supply chain supporting this locally emerging market. I'll throw that one to the mayor first. The mayor and Paul are looking at each other.
I think Paul's more the technical side. That's exciting that he's doing that and that there's a growing market for that sort of thing, because eventually, you know, the bus people are kind of ahead of this a little bit. Some of them are, I'll put it that way. And the American Public Transportation Association had their annual conference here in Indianapolis just a few weeks ago. And it was kind of exciting to see all of the technology that's going along with buses right now. You know, how what he particularly makes and can fit into what we're talking about, I'm not quite sure, to be honest with you. But it on the larger vehicles, I think you're going to see more of that.
There are a number of companies in Indiana that have a long history in electric vehicle component technology. Delphi makes power electronics and battery packs. Remy makes electric motors that are going in a number of electric and hybrid vehicles. Allison, of course, makes the hybrid bus system. So Enerdel still is manufacturing batteries for electric vehicles. Alternano, another company up in Anderson, is making batteries for the Proterra electric bus that the mayor was able to see when they were in town. So there certainly are companies locally that are in this space. I'd encourage your listener to go to www.energysystemsnetwork.com, our organization's website, and reach out to us, and we'd be happy to connect him to some of the firms that are working in this space.
So is there a possibility that this could be, you know, just as you know, we associate software development with certain parts of the country
absolutely.
And all of it, that we could become the center of electric?
There's so much going on here.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly why we got into this from our perspective. This was really about the industry and the companies and the economic development. And when the mayor's policy justification became apparent, it's making it even more exciting. But I think there's an opportunity for Indiana to lead the way. We've been in this industry for a long time. We can really be the Silicon Valley of electric vehicle technology. And 20 years from now, my hope is not only do we have a lot of electric cars on the road, but we've got a lot of companies and software firms manufacturing technologies and developing software for this industry.
What is the big obstacle right now, Paul? I'm going to stay with you for just a second. In terms of really seeing, I mean, what I am hearing right now is electric vehicles make a tremendous amount of sense for moving around a community. And to some degree, the hybrid, it sounds like the mayor said when he drove it down to
the plug-in hybrid.
What's keeping this from really exploding at this point?
You know, I think the mayor said it earlier. I think there's just not enough people that know that this technology exists and that it's ready for prime time. They've not driven the cars, so they think of them. They have misconceptions about the cars. They have misconceptions about the range that the cars can drive, et cetera. So I think, you know, the biggest barrier is we need to get the message out to more people. There needs to be more touch points where consumers are able to drive these cars, see the benefits of these cars. And as the Bolloré system comes to town and the city converts its fleet over, these are going to become more commonplace, and I think people will start to see the benefits, and they'll make their own decision to buy these cars. That's really, at the end of the day, this is about people buying cars, and they buy cars for a whole lot of different reasons, and we need to get this car in front of as many people as possible so that they can see the benefits and make that decision on
their own. So this actually could be an economic seed plan, basically, too, for development. We are talking about Indianapolis and electric vehicles here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard, Paul Mitchell of Energy Systems Network, and Cole Willis of IPL. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indianapolis's plug-in vehicle future. My guests are Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard, Paul Mitchell of Energy Systems Network, and Cole Willis of IPL. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Carrie, and if you want to send us a question by email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Says you have chosen not only an out-of-state but an out-of-country company to supply these charging, meaning Beloit, to supply these charging stations, when in fact there are Indiana-based companies that can provide the same or superior charging technology. Will there be any prohibition on locally based companies competing with your chosen supplier? Mayor, I think we'll throw that one to you.
Actually, they came to us, and they're the only one with this model that made a lot of sense to us. It's their entry point into North America. They're buying the charging stations, they're buying the cars, they're essentially setting it up. We have through the IURC and IPL, we're helping them with the installation of the charging stations. But other than that, that's pretty much all we're doing. So I mean, it made a lot of sense from a cost model, clearly, and there's nobody else that really does this sort of thing. It was almost not quite turnkey, but pretty close to turnkey, and it made a lot of sense to get it out there pretty quickly. But you know, it's not like anybody was designing this sort of system that we certainly that knew of or that came to us. This was a pretty much a ready-made system.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Justin who says, obviously e-cars are better than carbon and gas, but possibility for carbon neutral with wind generation, e-generation from IPL?
Yeah,
Cole, I think that one's in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, I think so. No, absolutely. And, you know, wind generation is part of our energy portfolio. We were just named the eighth largest wind generation per customer in the nation. So, you know, carbon neutral is definitely a part of that. We have renewable energy incentives for solar, for wind. And, you know, that's part of this whole initiative is creating a sustainable city, creating sustainable energy, and cutting down on those carbons with vehicles like this. So that's absolutely something we look into, something we're continuing to expand our portfolio through 2017. And, you know, it doesn't make sense if all these cars, if we're going to go from, you know, gasoline and carbon to everything being generated through coal and carbon. So we're absolutely aware of that, and we're continuing to move in that direction.
We're talking about Indianapolis and electric vehicles here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Joe, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How can you hear me?
We're doing fine. What's on your mind?
I'm mostly curious. Thank you for both kind of just answering my question just before you put me on. I was wondering about the benefits of going to an electric-powered car, which, as it stands right now, is more of a coal-powered car. And I was also wondering about how you're addressing the issue of are they lithium-ion batteries? Is that correct?
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
As to the carbon footprint of getting the rare earth metals from overseas suppliers to create the batteries.
Good question. I'll throw that one to
yeah.
Paul.
Thank you very much
for the call, Joe.
I mean, I think Cole answered the first part of the question, which is, you know, how are these cars powered by coal-fired electricity? And I think one thing that's important to realize is that the electric grid is continually getting cleaner, mm-hmm. right? Gasoline is not getting cleaner. Oil is not getting cleaner. So it takes time, but the IPL has been moving in that direction. I'd also point to some studies that have been done by EPRI and others that indicate that even an electric vehicle charged by a coal-fired power plant, electricity is cleaner than an internal combustion engine vehicle running on gasoline. The question about rare earth materials, yes, it is part of the battery production process, but you know what? It's part of what goes into every car that's built around the world. So it's in lithium-ion batteries, but it's also in a lot of other components that go into gasoline-powered vehicles. So this is a challenge that goes beyond electric vehicles. There have been efforts to try and open up new mines in California and other parts of the United States to begin getting those materials produced domestically. But it's going to be a global issue that's not just about electric cars. This is a concern related to the defense industry. It's a concern related to laptops, cell phones, et cetera.
And also, the lithium does not come from countries that want to do us harm.
Maggie, welcome to the program. Maggie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
I just joined the program, so I hope you haven't already answered this, but it sort of builds on what I just heard, which was something about firing up your car, your electric car, using coal-fired plants. And I wondered if there was any consideration giving to maybe having IPL for every 5 charging stations that they put in using traditional sources of energy, that they would have to put in one that's a solar charging station. The solar charging technology is already out there, so this isn't something that would have to be developed. It's already out there and being used in other states.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Maggie. Well, I'll throw that one to you, Cole.
No, absolutely. And so part of what to look at here is that Bolloré or, you know, Autoliv is coming in, and they're going to be the ones that are actually installing the stations. So as the utility locally, it's our responsibility, really, to provide electricity and to look into solar and wind for our overall portfolio and for our entire customer base, because basically when the city or Bolloré, whoever plugs in, they are one of our customers. So, you know, we have over 30 projects that are currently in the queue. That's going to put us at over 100 megawatts of solar energy. Mm-hmm. We're going to be number one in the central area of the country. So we're definitely looking at solar. That's a great idea. There are some stations that have solar canopies. And, you know, that'd be a great idea for Bolloré and to work with them. But we're making sure that we are providing a diverse energy portfolio.
Well, let me throw this to Paul real quickly. What is the next wave in this? I mean, you know, the technology is evolving so rapidly here. I mean, are we looking at a point where you could have solar-powered cars at some point?
Probably not solar-powered cars, but mm-hmm. maybe solar-powered charging stations, mm-hmm. as the listener just mentioned. I think where we're headed is a couple of advancements in technology that are key. One is better batteries. So that means lower cost, higher energy density, batteries that can take you not 70 miles per charge, but 150 miles per charge. And that's a game changer in terms of making longer distance travel a possibility and keeping the cost of electric vehicles or plug-in hybrid vehicles down. Then the other technology that's emerging are different ways to do charging. There's wireless charging that's being investigated, and a lot of companies are starting to push that. So you might have a charger in your garage that's charging your car wirelessly rather than having to plug it in.
Soon as you pull in,
I know this sounds like it's something space-aged, but it's really under discussions that could eventually be in the roadways, that some of the, especially for mass transit. So if you have electric buses going up and down the same route all the time, they may have wireless charging supporting those vehicles. The other thing that I think is you're going to see is just a much larger number of options in the marketplace. So right now, you still are pretty much dominated by the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt and the Prius plug-in. Ford now is coming out with their products, but BMW, Mercedes, other companies are coming to the marketplace with full EVs and plug-in hybrids. Most of that is going to happen around 2015 when the new CAFE standards kick in and more automakers have to bring these cars out as part of their fleet. And so I think one of the neat things that's going to happen is consumers who might not be interested in a more compact entry-level car but are interested in a plug-in hybrid Mercedes are going to have that option.
Mayor Ballard, I mean, this is a significant shift, and we're doing something that no other city in the country is doing. Is this a, you know, I know you, from talking with you in the past, you really don't like sort of the legacy kinds of questions. But this is going to be a significant mark on the city. Is it, if not the most important thing you've done as mayor in the top 5?
Could be. I would suggest to you that if this has the impact that I think it could, I think it would be a game changer for a lot of different ways, to be frank with you. It's bringing the other cities along. I made a speech at the Conference of Mayors in January at a plenary breakfast. It was very well received. other people are very interested in this around the country, getting a lot of attention on this. I think it's our job as the initiator of this to provide a model for that, and we are doing that. I told the mayors that by December I'll have the first year's data together, and we will make that available in January to them. The other piece is to try to get this out nationally, and internationally, frankly, because you know if you read the white paper that started all this, you know, if China and India continue to buy, you know, from Iran, and energy independence is kind of meaningless. I never really use that term anyways. So that's the point that we're trying to get to, that we can have a national influence. Cities get it. I'm hoping some states get it. Companies get it here locally, clearly. Monarch Beverage went to natural gas in their trucks. I mean, there's people who understand this. Citizens is really making a big push for liquefied natural gas. There's a lot of this going on locally. I think we've touched some buttons. This could really change things. I know I'm a little ahead of it because I've been studying it for a long time, and with my background, then this makes a lot of sense. If Indianapolis continues to lead in this way, I think it'd be good for the city, frankly.
We are talking about Indianapolis and electric vehicles here on No Limits. Anita, welcome to the program.
Hello. My question is much less technical, but the mayor does a good job moving snow in Indianapolis, but I'm just curious about how these cars do in the snow, because we do tend to get a lot of it in Indiana and might be a leader to show that it can be a nationwide vehicle.
How the cars do in the snow?
Yeah,
these are regular cars. These are just regular cars. I mean, when you look at the Ford Fusion and you look at, the Chevy Volt, these are just regular cars. Actually, in some cases, more powerful and acceleration than the other cars.
Well, the one thing I would notice, though, and Cole, I'll throw it to you in a second. I know with my own hybrid, and a lot of the more traditional hybrids that you talk about now, the gas mileage would drop significantly when you were when you were either in the winter months when you had to heat the car, or in the summer when you had to cool it. Is that the case with these?
Yeah, there's going to be some variation.
Thanks very much for the call.
Very similar to a regular, car where your gas mileage goes down when you have to run the AC or the air conditioning. But, you're going to have the same thing with a battery the distance that battery can fuel that car shrinks a little bit. And then in performance in the snow, you think about these, they have heavy batteries in the bottom of them. Mm-hmm. And they're actually, I drive one very frequently, and they do very well in the snow because they are very bottom heavy, and many of them are front wheel drive. So, the combination of those two things are two reasons why I've driven it during the winter, I've driven it in the snow, and didn't see any difference in performance, really.
One thing on the Volt, it was kind of neat, there's a little ball there. Mm-hmm. And that you try to keep it, when you drive it, you look at it, and you almost try to keep it in there where it's most efficient. So if you accelerate, you can see it move out a little bit. If it's too low, you see it move out. And it's really kind of fun to try to keep the ball in there as to be most efficient.
Well, and I notice on my own hybrid, there is a bar, in effect, that tells you when you're maximizing performance. And, that's the other thing, is that will this ultimately, I'm going to throw this one to Paul Mitchell, change some of the behavior patterns too, because you've never really had that. Oh, okay. If I step on the accelerator this hard, this is what it's costing me. Not had that information at my disposal before. Is it really worth it to me to get there 6 seconds faster?
I'm a little conflicted on that, because I think for the plug-in hybrid vehicles, yes, that's the case, because you're trying to get as much electric miles as you can out of the vehicle, and then when it moves into hybrid mode, you're trying to make it the most efficient. With pure electric vehicles, one of the benefits of a pure electric vehicle is electric torque. Electric torque from 0 to 30 is usually more efficient and speedier than an internal combustion engine vehicle. If you take a Honda Civic, gasoline vehicle, and compare it off the start to a Nissan Leaf, the Nissan Leaf is a much faster car. That's why Tesla has been so successful selling these high-end sports cars that are pure electric. So for a pure electric car, I think it really depends. If you know that you're only going to be traveling 30 miles that day, and you've got 70 miles range, and you want to get some performance out of your car, you have the ability to do that, and there's nothing wrong with that, and you're very efficient in the process because it's 100% electric. So I do think that consumers who are driving plug-in hybrid vehicles will benefit from this phenomenon of more intelligent driving. I think consumers who are driving electric vehicles, if they're not trying to conserve range, then they may drive them more aggressively, and that's okay.
We are talking about electric vehicles in Indianapolis here on No Limits. Michael, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I just had a couple of quick questions. First, you mentioned the battery life, the long-term battery life with subsequent use could be 40 years. What's the battery life of the batteries in the vehicle? And then how much does replacement of the batteries cost? My final question is, once the battery has been depleted and you're running on gasoline as opposed to electric, is the gasoline engine recharging the battery while it's subsequently driving the car?
Good questions. Thanks very much. Yeah. Paul?
I'll try to do these very quickly. So to the first question, most of the batteries, if not all the batteries in the major OEM vehicles are warrantied for 8 years. When you ask how long they last, it's a little bit of a loaded question. They're basically guaranteeing you that for 8 years, you're going to get the range that they promised you or that you that was on the sticker when you bought the car. What happens is the battery doesn't just die. It starts to not have the same power that it had before, just like your cell phone battery mm-hmm. or your laptop battery. So instead of getting 70 miles, you may start getting 65 and 60 and so on and so forth. So at some point, it's up to the consumer what their tolerance is for the range going down after it gets to 10 years old and beyond. The replacement of the battery, tough to say. In 10 years, prices are probably going to go down. Right now, those batteries are pretty expensive.
How anywhere, expensive?
Well,
are they?
They're anywhere from $8,000 to $15,000. They're about 50% of the car's cost a lot of times.
So basically, once your battery's done, you buy a new car.
Or you sell that car, and people are still able to use it. As I mentioned, they may just not get the same range that they had gotten when you bought it off the lot. The second question. Remind me what the second question was.
Well, the second question was the cost of the battery, as I recall. But I guess the other thing that we ought to keep in mind here, picking up on your earlier point, Paul, is too that even after it's not useful as a car battery, there's a second life for it too. So there's still some value to the vehicle.
Yeah, the residual value can kick in then potentially at the 8 or 10 years. You may have somebody who buys that battery from you, not to put in another vehicle, but to use on a secondary application.
Mayor, I'm going to give you the last word here, since we're getting close on time. In what way do you think ultimately, we've talked about how this can reshape the dialogue, you know, and our position in terms of negotiating with energy producing nations and all of that and enhance security. What's the biggest way it's going to change the way people live in Indianapolis?
They're going to, I think intelligent was a good word that Paul just used. I think they're going to be more intelligent in their use of energy. I do think this will enable the creative class around the country to look at Indianapolis in a different way. Maybe we're ahead of the game, and so maybe they'll come here. Companies will come here as a result of this. That's certainly a secondary benefit of what we're doing. Not much question about that. We look like we're ahead of the game, that this is a city on the move that gets it and can put the pieces together and make things happen. I think that's a great benefit also. But ultimately, this is about putting this into the consumer mindset and making sure they understand that these are viable technologies now, and they're only going to get better.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests for being with us and our listeners for joining the program. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes, and Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.